right, we're back. Mailbag. Hope you enjoyed David Mills. Great conversation. Thought it added to the show. Nice long show here today. Give you a little extra content here on this midsummer night, late mid-July, getting into the dog days of August. Summer goes by so quick. It's like you start to see that warm weather, and I think it was a little bit colder. We didn't feel like it was summer as early as it normally I think there wasn't much of a spring, to tell you the truth. I mean, we had snow so damn late this year. But it's like you wake up and the summer's like halfway over. And when I was a kid, it was like, forget about college when you got out in May. Like, you got out like mid to like third week of June when you're in grade school or even high school. And it just felt like the summer was endless. And maybe that's when you're young and you have not as much responsibility and things like that. But wow, it just flies by. But anyway, got a lot of comments from you in the chat room. Got some emails to get to. I want to get to a couple things. The first thing I want to do is I want to talk about this whole iPad dugout controversy. So listen to Adam Onivino, former Mets pitcher. He has a podcast, talk about the controversy with teams using AI in the dugout.
Did you see the story on MLB banning the custom tab on the in-dugout iPad? Any thoughts? Yes, I knew about this for a while. The Mets were actually the main team that got cracked down on. They had an AI program that was very expensive, apparently, and they were bragging about it a little bit early on in the year. Some of the coaches that I know were talking about it from around the league, and they had basically an AI program helping them pick pitches. And I think some other stuff, but MLB got wind of it and nipped that right in the butt. So apparently they weren't the only team, but I knew about it from the Mets angle, which, they try to throw some money at the situation. Steve ponied up for, I think this program, from what I heard, was several hundred thousand dollars to have.
All right, so you heard from Ottavino, and here's my thing. I understand what the league is doing. I don't blame the Mets for trying to use AI, and I don't know how AI, other than churning numbers, what I'm guessing it did at a high level is depending on the count, look at what the hitter is potentially susceptible to and maybe helping call pitches for the dugout. We know the Marlins are doing this. It sounds like the Mets were at the forefront. I'm guessing other teams were as well. The Mets might just have had a very expensive program. I'm sure there's ways they could still use it. It didn't work. Think about it. So they ever complain about the Mets' use of AI? Clearly, it didn't work. They had an historical losing streak. They're one of the worst five teams in baseball. And look, it's not working for Senga. For a large part of the season, it didn't work for Manaea. Didn't work for David Peterson when he was here. But anyway, be that as it may, this is another example of what I've talked about, that I think the problem with baseball is. And I think, and this has been brought up in mailbags in the past, the Mets are very heavily analytics, and that was always Steve Cohen's desire. And I talked about this years ago when, even before they hired Billy Epler, that he really wanted, from what I understood, a highly analytical front office. And I think that, yeah, he's got J.D. Martinez in there now, and it's good to have some former players. Carlos Beltran, obviously, is part of the front office. Whether he's going to be the next manager and get another shot at this thing, we'll see. But it would be nice to have somebody who had some playing experience and understands the players. And Beltran, and I think Andy Green, again, I've said this, I think he's perfect right now when you have all these developmental type of situations at the big league level. But I've always liked what I've heard from Andy Green. He's like a straight shooter. He seems to really be able to, at least it appears, connect with this group. They played a little bit better since he's come on board. They've been so buried. I don't really look at the score. Forget about the scoreboard. It's the type of play. The play seems a little bit better. You can't overcome bad pitching. Senga's a mess. Manaea is a back in the rotation starter. You've had the sloppiness from the closer situation, and you are probably a bat short, at least maybe two bats. So those are things no manager could overcome. But I do think he's a straight shooter, and I do think he's good for this club. But he doesn't want the job, so it would be interesting to see what kind of baseball person, a real experienced baseball person. And I think that's my biggest gripe about the baseball is so much about the front office. The front office literally wants to control everything. They're trying to turn this into a video game or fantasy baseball or Strat-O-Matic. And there's a lot of nuance there, and you really need to have the ability. And I think that a team that figures this out, where they give a manager the information and then they allow that manager to figure out what works and what doesn't with the information, how deep does he go? Just because they have certain analytical principles, if the manager has a feel or gut feel or is down on the field, like, I think that the coaches and the managers, there has to start to be a turn where the field is the field and the front office is the front office. And it's so blended. It's almost like this front office wants to have like a desk in the dugout during the game. I know I'm probably exaggerating and I sound like, you know, get off my lawn, because I am all for, and I incorporate advanced stats into my conversation. But I think when you're on the field, especially with the personality that a dugout leader could bring, I mean, how many people still think of, you know, they'll be celebrating the 86 Mets in a couple of weeks, 40th anniversary. I mean, David Johnson is still iconic. You don't talk as much about Frank Cashin, but there's always people talking about David Johnson. Frank Cashin was the architect of that 80s teams, those 80s teams, that 86 team. So I think this is another example, less so about the tech and getting into baseball, cracking down on what could become cheating, because I think it's debatable whether using AI is cheating, because they're probably using some components of it leading into the game. But it's another example where you're trying to take away any kind of critical thinking skills from the people that you put in charge, and almost not even have your players, your pitchers or catchers think. And I think that kind of atrophy of thinking is a dangerous thing, because they're down there on the field. They have all this institutional knowledge from the years of catching, whether it be in the big leagues, the minor leagues, you know, being down there, looking at players' mannerisms and how they feel. They may mention something in the batter's box, or you may see something. Like, there's so many little things that are not going to be picked up with an AI program that I think it's a good thing that they clamp down on MLB, but I'm looking at it from a different perspective. So we have that. Let's go to the chat room. Josh writes, do you think this is a rebuild? If not, what makes you think this team can compete next year? We have a bad pitching staff and an offense that produced 4-point runs per game with nothing coming from the minor leagues. Not sure I understand any optimism for next year. So, Josh, I talked about it in the open. You saw some of the optimism this weekend with McClain and Scott. Thornton is the third piece of that. We'll see how he does. And he's going to be kind of on the clock the rest of the year. I know that the veterans in the back half of the rotation, Manaea, Senga, you know, Holmes, when he comes back, I think lengthens that rotation. But anybody else I know is not as exciting to you. And that's certainly, the rotation is thin because you don't know. There is some. Santucci had a nice outing down the minors. I think he struck out 12 today. So there is potentially Weininger's down there. I know that they, you know, may not be ready, but there's some more arms on the way. The Mets still have a checkbook that they could write. They could still go out there and potentially deal for another starter. I understand the offense averaging 4.1 runs per game, but look, when you don't have Lindor, and then Lindor doesn't hit when he comes back, and Bichette got off to the awful start that he got off to, and you didn't have Ewing the first couple of months of the year, and Benj got off to a really bad start his first 30 days in the big leagues, that 4.1, they're more of a 4.5 runs per game, I tell you. They're probably more league average-ish now that they have all their players back and they've kind of normalized. Not great, because there still could be brownouts, and there's no difference in this offense from other years. The only difference is that the core offensive players, the five or six core offensive players, have not been consistent. Even in 2022, when the Mets won 101 games, it was McNeil, it was Alonso, it was Lindor, it was those guys. Nimmo, it was hit or miss outside of the core four or five hitters. This year, but the Mets always 22, 23, 24, even to a large degree 25, they got consistent play out of their core hitters, and it was the surrounding guys that didn't hit the muster. This year, you didn't have that luxury of a core players carrying you, and you were exposed by the lack of production, particularly for some of the young players. So we'll see. But I think there should be optimism. And I don't know if there's nothing coming in the minor leagues. I think, you know, maybe offensively there's not as much, but I think pitching-wise, I think there's bullpen arms. I think that you'll be surprised what's coming. And by the way, keep going back to what I said. They promoted potentially three mainstay starters over the last 12 months, and I put Scott coming back from TJ into the last 12 months. So that's my optimism, and I think that that's going to be, Josh, a big part of the rest of the second half, rest of the season, is figuring out, is it realistic to contend in 2027? James writes, is there a fracture between Lindor and the team? Not the player, but ownership and management. I don't think he'll be traded before the deadline, but I almost feel like he could get moved in the offseason more now than ever. James, I don't know. The leaking of Mets willing to deal him and listen, I have a hard time. Now, I know that Stearns has been criticized for lack of communication, and that's fair. I mean, there were some things that came out of that Chavez interview we talked about a few weeks ago from a communication standpoint is fair. I know Lindor has a pretty open relationship with the owner and the owner's wife, so I find it hard to believe that he's in the dark. And, I mean, look, Cohen, Lyke, and Pete, Cohen, Lyke, and Nimmo didn't stop them from trading those guys. But in general, you know, it's not like they couldn't pick up the phone and talk to him. So I don't think so, James. I'd be surprised about that. And I think that it's really hard to pick a fight or not communicate with one of your highly paid players. I mean, the guys who make the big money, they have the ability to go top all the time. You know, if Stearns is not doing that, shame on him. But I think the owner would be somebody they'd call right away. I mean, look, Scherzer, if you remember when Epler told them they were looking to take a step back in 2024 before they trade him, he called Cohen himself when he had to waive his no trade clause. He called him. You don't think Lindor's doing that? So Lewis writes, I think we're in the midst of a rebuild, but one that's allowed the team to be competitive. What's funny to me are the very same people that still whine and cry for Pete Alonso and how they didn't have a replacement for him are also the ones who, without hesitation, say trade Lindor for a bag of balls if you have to and there's no real replacement. Make it make sense. No, Lewis, it doesn't, because this is all emotional stuff. And I think it comes down to Pete was this big frat boy emotional leader that connected better with the fans than Lindor. I think just Pete was, he presented them, whether it's probably a certain level of phoniness to it. Pete presented himself as this big, lovable character. And I think the fans appreciated it. And look, Pete would be very helpful on this team. But at 31, still very productive, still driving in runs. He's going to hit 30 home runs and drive at 100 runs. He does that every year. But he's a guy that, again, you look at his numbers and how he's last year with the doubles, or even, you know, even in 2024 when his OPS was below 800. He's hovering around an 800 OPS. He's probably going to dip. You just can't give $30 million a year for 5 years. If Pete was willing to do a 2 or 3 year deal, I think the Mets would have considered it. They were not going to go 5 years, and once they knew that's what he wanted, to a bust, forget it. They weren't going to be interested in that. But nothing against Pete. With the CBA and all the uncertainty, I understand the Mets' hesitancy to put a $30 million a year player that, in year one of his contract with the Orioles, is not having his worst season of his career, but it's toward the bottom rung of production you've seen from Pete Alonso throughout his tenure. The Pete Alonso that you saw in 25, the only other year you saw that was 2022. That's a guy that's an outlier. That's not the consistent. And that doesn't mean that the guy that you're seeing now wouldn't be helpful. And I do think he should be, and I knew he'd always get 5 years, 100. If you go back, you look at my writings. And I was in favor of the Mets at that point. You know, hey, it's just money. It's Cohen's money. But when you start to think about potentially how big this payroll can get and the percentage of the payroll that just Soto and Lindor and you know, as some of these young players get expensive, I mean, eventually, if they are who they are, Ewing and Benj will get expensive, and how pitching, even basic back in the rotation starters, mid-tier starters, cost $25 million a year. That's market value. It's very hard to have these kind of expenses at every position. And the Mets thought that, and they were wrong because Bichette has not had the same year. That Bichette was going to give you a lot of the production, and Polanco can make up for some of Nimmo's production. So they looked at it from an analytical standpoint that Pete could be made up, and it didn't happen. So I kind of veered off on that, but that's, you know, part of, you know, what I see. Barry writes, what do you think of Stearns leaving Lindor off the not available for trade list? Considering the Mets don't have a hot shot prospect ready in the minors to play short, why would he do that? Was it to insult Lindor, and for what reason? To get Lindor to waive his no trade? This move shows Stearns' deep shortcomings in understanding human behavior, emotions, and the impact of the athlete's mental state on performance. Between his recent injuries, the team struggles, and his own poor performance, Lindor has a lot of pressure on him. Stearns, for no rational reason, dismissed Lindor's burden and acted in self-centered, uncaring manner. Perhaps Stearns needs to spend time with Alex Cohen to learn a bit about caring for others and doing what is honorable for fans, staff, and players. So, Barry, look, there's nothing that you just said that I disagree with. I have a hard time believing, because it was out in the media, that there's any way, shape, or form a slap to Lindor. If a team calls and says, can I talk to you about Lindor? Sure. That doesn't mean you're trading him. And same thing with anybody else. Hey, I'm interested in McClain and Scott. Like, all right, they're really not available, but okay, what do you got? I mean, maybe you don't even want to bother talking about it. But to me, we're reading into information that's coming outside of the Mets organization. And I don't think it's Lindor's agent leaking it. It's from other teams that may have inquired about Lindor. I do not think that there's been no credible information coming from the Mets, from the sources that I talked about earlier in the show, that he's available. That's it. Joe writes, hey, Mike, what do you think of the mindset fans seem to have with these long-term contracts? I'm all for listening to offers, but I think we have to stop thinking we're going to get every big contract halfway through. Yes, it worked with Nimmo. It made sense due to the outfield process, but this stuff is more the exception, the rule. Maybe you can cut bait in the last year or two if Cohen is willing to absorb the cost, but not much more than that. Joe, I think the largesse of Cohen has spoiled Mets fans in a way where, well, this isn't working, just write a check, get him out of here because I don't want to see him. After years of having to suffer through Ollie Perez, Luis Castillo, or just contracts that went bad, Jason Bay, that hamstrung the Mets quite a bit post-Madoff. So now we've swung the pendulum the other way. It's bad business. Same thing with Semien. You don't just cut bait. You got to see what you got there. Can you get something out of him? I mean, you might be at a time where it's, and it will be, and maybe by this time next year, if what we see, you can't even get, you know, slightly below league average hitter and back to some semblance of the glove that seemed to still be part of his repertoire even last year. But you know, that to me is part of the problem. Like, people just think it is monopoly money in a lot of ways. In essence, it's such stupid money. But it isn't monopoly money. It's a business. And there's only so much that he'll lose, Cohen, before he's going to say, hey, we need to stabilize this. He's learning very quickly that it's very hard to rebuild and contend and build an organization at the same time. Now, you may not like the organization they built with Stearns, but they have an organization. That's why I keep saying you got to give them the next 24 months, the next 2 years. And you evaluate towards the end of year five where you're at and whether or not you want to continue and go forward. Or in the interim, does he bring in other non-analytic baseball people? Does he bring in a GM that has a little bit of a different perspective than him to help him? I don't know. I don't know how they're going to do that. They don't really leak, and you really don't get a feel of those that do work for him, his assistant GMs, his cabinet. You know, are they doing a lot of those responsibilities already? And is it too analytically based? You know, that's probably an easy answer, is yes. So, you know, we'll see. Matt writes, what do you think a realistic, successful season will look like next year? What will you be looking for to make you feel more comfortable that Stearns is the right person for the job? And by contrast, what warning signs will you be looking for to indicate that Stearns is not the right person moving forward? That's a loaded question, Matt, and I think that it's probably one that we're going to be discussing a lot. First, I think that this team, outside of the 12-game losing streak, which was such a weird outlier, you know, they should have probably won four or five games any normal team, you know, should have won four or five games. And you look at that, you know, the Mets have another five wins or so. They're 46 and 53. Still not good. Still substandard. I think that a team that, and the progress that you're going to make is, I don't think next year, unless they make some significant acquisitions, you know, going out and going bananas on the free agent market, which I don't expect, or all of a sudden that kids like Beatty and Alvarez do best case scenarios, I don't think you could expect more than a team that's in the muck. I think next year at this time, we should at the very least be talking about, similar to the Phillies, look at the Phillies, 55 and 44, Miami 52 and 47, Yankees 10 games over. Now the Mets should be in that muck of a wild card in some way, shape, or form. Not like below or a pretend wild card. They should be in the mix where they have a chance to make the postseason. I don't see why they can't. I really don't. I think that the real key will be the young players, because you're going to start to see players that he drafted, he developed, you know, start. You've already started to see with the starting pitching, bullpen arms. Maybe Nick Morabito comes up and he's a backup outfielder. You're going to start to see the fruits of that farm system, not just on the elite players, but the component players, the players that round out a roster, bullpen arms, back in the rotation starters, bench players, things like that. So to me, that will determine whether or not I believe he's doing a good job. I think you have to see a foundation of a core group of players. I think you're seeing it with Benji and Ewing, Soto. I think Lindor is towards the end of their line here, but he's going to be part of that for a while. I think they're one or two short on that. McLean and Scott, and obviously guys like that are part of it too on the pitching side. I do not think this is a team that, as currently constituted, needs to be torn apart and rebuilt. Now, if he fails this offseason, let's assume it's somewhat of a normal offseason in some way, shape, or form, lockout or otherwise. If he fails to put together even a competent team with what I see that they have right now, the foundational pieces, you know, you should be able, with what they have, with some proper moves around them, field a team that could win, you know, in the mid-80s, and maybe with a couple of bounces of the ball going well, be a wild card winner. I mean, that's what they were in 24. The Stearns has taken teams that Mets fans thought were a lot better, and I think we thought last year's team was a lot better because of the way they started, but we were fooled. They've been low to mid-80s win teams, and the one that got hot late made the wild card. There's a lot of variability there between disappointment and success. Can the foundation and the baseline be enough where, hey, you're guaranteed to be 83, 84, 85? Can some of the moves push them into another level? I think the real key will be pitching and the young pitchers, but of course, can he go find, and will they have the budget to find some veteran starters that could potentially help? I mean, that's a whole nother story, a whole nother situation. All right, let's, Andy writes, I want to share my thoughts on Fanatics Fest, which I attended on Friday and Saturday. Overall, it was a fun experience that I would recommend, and I got to see and meet a bunch of current and former athletes. However, Derek Jeter's appearance was a bit annoying. You might have seen the clip of him poking fun at the Mets with the Pete Alonso card he pulled, but during the 5 minutes I was in the crowd, he made several of the digs at the Mets that didn't even make it to the internet. It was so much that I actually had to leave for another event. For someone who claimed in his documentary they never cared about the Mets, he certainly seemed to be having a great time at their expense. On the bright side, Aaron Judge was very nice and classy, so I'll give the Yankees credit for that. Shifting to the Mets themselves, did you find it crazy that they played Thursday's game with the air quality index was 170? It seemed completely unsafe, though I guess they pulled it off. So first, the Fanatics Fest, I didn't go. You got to probably have a second mortgage if you want to get some of the big-name players. I did see some of the goofy stuff, Tom Brady getting into a fight with Logan Paul, the Knicks stuff. I saw Jeter's comment. I saw Judge on the Roommates podcast. Jeter is a phony. He's an unlikable guy. He's a socially awkward, unlikable guy. And he was a great player. He was an intense leader. I think you see a lot of principles that are good out of Jeter. The focus, the level, the balance, the playing every day, the determination. Really such a great example. When a guy like that goes out, plays a premium position, probably plays hurt, and performs at his normal level, even in the postseason when you're facing the best talent, you know, that's a great player. I think he's a little overrated in some of the ways. He was a very good player. I think if he didn't play for the Yankees, he's robbing you out. And I think not being in the spotlight bothers him. And I think the only way he gets some attention is poking fun of the Mets. He's always had this weird thing about the Mets, almost like they're them existing in the city is an affront to him. So I don't even know what to think about him. As far as the quality, I mean, so weird, the air index. I mean, games getting canceled. I can't answer that, Andy, other than I think if the players were in danger or they felt like they couldn't perform, they would have done something. But, yeah, I mean, and part of that, I think, because they were off on Friday, and I think that had to do, I don't know what they had on Friday. Was there? I know the World Cup was one of the reasons why they were off on a Friday, but what was the reason why the, you know, I'll look it up right here. Why were the Phillies, why did the Phillies not play Friday? Let's see. I guess that was actually just a regular, let me see. I guess they actually, you know what? It was just because they didn't get the extra day off. Because I guess they had the national game on Thursday. Just, that doesn't make any sense. I guess because the Apple game gets national time. I guess they just got the day off because they didn't get the day off Thursday. Well, whatever. So, TV and money, Andy, runs things. In terms of team strategy, I really don't think moving Alvarez to the DH is the right move as it would severely hurt his trade value. Also, it looks like the team got caught using AI in the dugout and the league has to now put a stop to it. I already addressed that. I talked about on the premium content, Alvarez the DH. His numbers are much better as a DH. I do agree it takes away his value. I also think it creates a situation where you lose some roster flexibility because you have a player that really can only DH and maybe occasionally catch. So you have to put another catcher on the roster, which more than likely would be a light-hitting defensive player like a Hayden Senger. So it's complicated. A DH only, unless he's big poppy. And also, let's not forget, Soto might have to be big poppy late in his career, just DH, as he gets deeper into his late 20s, early 30s. So it was an idea. It was something to bring up discussion. Clearly, the numbers indicate he's better hitter as a DH, and his catching skills have declined. But I agree with you on that. Looking at the standings, it's incredibly frustrating. The media and the fan base have been so focused on how we can pass the Braves and the Phillies, yet the whole time the Marlins and the Nationals have surpassed us by a decent margin. Seeing two rebuilding clubs with far fewer resources ahead of us is what makes me the angriest. I just can't believe this is our reality. David Stearns has to find a way out of this. It's honestly a lot to handle right now. And I think, Andy, this is why Mets fans are so frustrated. And look, the Nats and Marlins have been rebuilding for a while. They got a executive in Miami from the Tampa Bay organization. The Nats have been rebuilding for a long while, for about 5 years. So, you know, they have some good young players that got them from, you know, by trading Soto. They did well with the Soto trade. They got a good young manager in Butera that I heard great things about a couple of years ago. That, you know, some people I had talked to thought the Mets should have interviewed him back when they had an opening, when the Mendoza got the job. So the National League East is going to be tough. I mean, Pittsburgh is better. In the Central, the Cardinals don't seem to be as bad as you think. Cubs, obviously, have been good. It looks like the West, with San Diego taking a step back, maybe because of the ownership change, Colorado being Colorado. Mets got their work cut out for them to make the playoffs in this league, especially now that you don't have, and I talked about this in prior weeks, now that you don't have potentially 25, 26 easier games in your division, where Miami and Washington are much more of a challenge. Steve writes, "Hi, Mike. I've been seeing your post on X and think you might be getting a bit too wound up with the idea of Lindor being traded. I got really upset how the fans wanted to just throw him away. I really did. I mean, it was so illogical. It was so emotional. And I know I shouldn't get into the weeds, but yeah, you're right, Steve. I shouldn't have. First of all, he's likely isn't going anywhere given his contract and age, but even if he were traded, would it really be the worst thing? He's a declining player who's missed playing more balls lately. Most shortstops don't play the position in their mid-30s for a reason. I don't think a new glove is the real issue. Between the massive contract, the locker room drama, like the incident with McNeil or not getting along with Nimmo, him and Alonso didn't follow each other back on Instagram, and the fact that Cone admitted he doesn't get along with Soto, there's a lot to consider. Plus, he and his wife bring politics into things, and the team is mostly lost with him anyway. They can lose without him, too. he's not an innocent bystander. I don't disagree, Steve, with that. The politics, I just don't pay attention to. It's his wife, and I haven't really seen a ton from him. And, I mean, look, you're never going to get guys to love each other. It's not about loving each other off the field or following on Instagram. Is can they come into a locker room and perform to the best version of themselves within the atmosphere set? You know, if I was on a ball club, I'm a private guy. I like to go home and be with my family, my wife, myself. I'm kind of an introvert, which is interesting because I do a radio show, right? I don't like hanging out a lot. So maybe people would think I'm not a good locker room guy if I was in the Mets locker room. But if I did my job and I focused on being the best version of whatever my position Mike Silva was, does it matter? Something to think about. I also noticed you were angry when fans suggested trading Nimmo, but then you changed your tune once the trade actually happened. Trading Lindor would be for the same reason, trying to move away from a declining player in a long contract. I personally wouldn't miss him, and I'm curious why you would. You also don't need to get so angry when people have a different opinion on him. I think it's way different. I think Nimmo, and I love Nimmo, had shown decline being the elite run creator. He was a different player, a more replaceable player, that he wasn't that elite run creator that he was early in his career. He was more of a, yeah, great, hit home runs, drove in RBIs. I thought the lower body injuries, the ones that particularly we saw in the postseason, I didn't think it was going to get any better. Benjamin Ewing were on the way. I think Benj in particular was somebody everybody was excited about. Lindor's plays a premium position. Lindor's maybe a Hall of Famer. Nimmo's not. So I don't think that they're the same. Fair enough. Can he play shortstop into his mid-30s? I still don't see physical tools declining. I think it's more, I think it's more just the mind and the body. I feel like he rushes too much. Now, maybe that's part and parcel to a decline in physical talents and he feels he has to rush more, but that's to me. Looking at the draft, I wish the Mets had addressed positional players more. This trade deadline is critical for reshaping the future, especially with a struggling major league team and a farm system ranked 24th. We need young, controllable, and cheap talent. You've mentioned how Beatty, Alvarez, and Mauricio have set the organization back, but what about Billy Epler's 2023 trade deadline? Cohen paid down a lot of money to get better prospects, and they all ended up underperforming. Not one good player came out of those trades to retool the future. That was a major failure on Epler's part, and Stern simply must do better of selling off for prospects. Get as many prospects as you can and identify better talent than Epler could. Also remember, Scherzer and Verlander, as pitchers that were at the end of the rope, there was probably some thought that they weren't who you think they could be. You know, there wasn't, I think, the same. And also, there was the no trade with Scherzer. I mean, there was a lot of restrictions with Scherzer and Verlander. You couldn't just go anywhere with them. I think if you want to trade Luke Weaver and you get a haul, a lot different. So I agree with you, Steve, but I think Epler, it's not apples to apples, especially with those guys. And I think paying down the salary with those guys was necessary even to get a team to consider to give up anything. That's why, in a way, unless you needed to get off the salary, you almost were better off keeping them around and trying to see if you could. I think they could have made a run and maybe squeezed into making it interesting the rest of the year, that team. They were starting to play a little bit better. They just won at Yankee Stadium, and then they started ripping it apart with Roberts and this. And you're right, they didn't get much out of it. But I think Epler, at that point, was looking to meet the mandate of not a sustainable winning situation, and he felt that he needed to shed some salary. And those are the best assets he could get. I mean, we weren't in the room. We don't know what other deals were out there. But I think when you have no trade players and aging pitchers like Scherzer and Verlander, we're starting to show the check engine light coming on. I think it's a little bit tougher than with Lindor, which in a lot of ways, if he's a similar type, that's why it's probably not a good idea to trade him, because you're not going to get full value. You're going to have to pay the contract down. And because of the risk of age and whatnot, you may get, to a certain degree, a riskier package. We'll end off with Allison. Allison, Mike, for one, I don't watch the All-Star Break or the Home Run Derby. I don't get a thrill from home runs per se, especially when they aren't in the context of a game. I agree with many people that the All-Star games become almost meaningless with the ability to see baseball from different teams and stars as often as one's technology and vision allows throughout the season. I'm a fan of history and like the idea of having some sort of celebration that honors players from the past that the younger generation may not know about, even ones from 100 years ago, to show how long baseball has been popular in America. During the Civil War, there was pop-up games when there were lull and horrendous fighting. Of course, baseball has changed drastically from then. Yet, That could be a selling point, comparing games and rules and players from different eras. Maybe make it a generational all-star game each year. In any case, I think the players really need a true break during this time of the year, and the 2 or 4 days old they get if they attend tournaments during the week, not really a rest, and it takes them away from both their families and their teams. Allison, I agree. I talked about this on the premium side. I didn't watch a lick of the All-Star game. You know, naming the teams is fine, and that's appropriate, but I'm not so sure that I'm all that interested in the game itself. Can they do some kind of, like, look at what Andy wrote about how much you like Fanatics Fest. Maybe something like a Fanatics Fest for baseball during the All-Star break. Think about that. Maybe we're onto something. You probably can make a lot of money. You pick a town. And, you know, maybe you get kind of like the past, present, and future. You know, there might be some sort of a trade show aspect to it. Almost like a in-season, not the winter meetings, but like the trade show part of winter meetings. Honor the game, honor history, educate. Really get people excited about the sport in a way that isn't just them being forced to watch a meaningless game. So you might be on some there, Allison. So I have given you a lot of content today, well more than an hour. Hope you enjoyed it. Got to wrap up here. I'm tired. Wow, a lot of radio today. Hope you enjoyed David Mills. Obviously, we're kicking off the silly season of rumors and trades and all sorts of craziness. But in the long run, I think what you saw this weekend, like I said, in Philly, is the reason why there's hope. McLean, Scott, we'll see what Thornton brings this week. Ewing and Benj, and maybe finally the Mets with those two kids lengthening the lineup, a core. You now have a core of offensive players that now the task for Stearns is to continue to build the farm system but add to the roster around the edges and maybe even find a core star, another core pitcher or two. Not easy, but this is not a wasteland here. There's something to work with, and it's not because they won 2 out of 3 at the Phillies. It's the performances. We're about, as we are in extended spring training for the rest of the year, we're going to be learning about what this team has and whether or not they could contend. It's almost like a getting to know you phase again, but we're learning because you have to kind of reset the whole thing because there's nothing to play for. So we're in that learning phase again as we go into the dog days of August post-trade deadline. All right, that's it. Hope everybody enjoyed today's show. You can check me out all the time at thetalkingmetspodcast.com. You get me on X at TalkingMetsNoG and on your favorite podcasting service, Apple, Spotify, pretty much whatever podcasting service you desire. If you want to interact with me, Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com. NoG, Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com. You could get me on thetalkingmetspodcast.com. Chat for free, premium content, updates on the show, all at thetalkingmetspodcast.com. And I want to thank the good folks in the Believe Network for supporting this show. I'm your host, Mike Silva. Enjoy the rest of your Sunday. We'll be back with another Talking Mets podcast next week. In the interim, why not sign up for some premium content, some cool stuff throughout the week? You never know what happens here at the Talking Mets podcast. Till then, take care, everybody.